From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll talk about controversial technology today. First, we'll weigh whether body cameras hold police accountable. Then we'll look into online currency and we'll learn about Bitcoin.
Yeah, I could do that. It should take about 2 minutes. Just PayPal me some Bitcoins when you get a chance.
What?
That's coming up this hour. First, though, the New York Post published nude photos of potential First Lady Melania Trump on its front page last week. We debated in the break room Friday whether that publication crossed a line. The jury was split.
We as a nation, we as voters, need to know what would lay ahead of us if they become the first couple. And I think it's kind of good to know. And then the other point is that whatever we do in our life, and it's out there in, you know, cyberspace, stays out there. So it's a lesson to be learned as well.
I grew up watching Chelsea Clinton get tortured by media for not being what they thought was a pretty girl. And so I completely disagree with the photos, the nude photos, and putting and criticizing Melania in general.
Are candidates' families fair game in a presidential election? Here are your first thoughts. Janet Garrison Burns writes on Facebook, if this were any other candidate, I would say definitely off limits. But this is the man chosen to represent the party of family values. The hypocrisy is astounding. She's definitely fair game. Cass Mudd tweets, Trump's wife and kids are all adults and chose to become involved in his campaign, hence they are no longer off target. And the Punchline Comedy Club had this to add, don't know if potential future First Lady is off limits, but Post is a big Trump backer, so not an accident. The New York Post endorsed Trump earlier this year. We always love to hear what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Millions of students across the country will enter their first year of college this month. That includes my son, Grant. College can be a very tough transition for students. As many as 1 in 3 students will not return for their sophomore year. That's according to national data collected by U.S. News and World Report, which features freshman retention rates between fall 2010 and fall 2013. Kennesaw State University is one of 44 institutions taking part in a national initiative to help kids finish their degrees. It's called Reimagining the First Year of College. Chris Hutt can explain. He's Vice President of Academic Advising at Kennesaw State. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And also with us is Julie Onsis. She's the Vice President for Institute Diversity at Georgia Tech. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me. And I'm the Associate Vice President.
The Associate Vice President for Institute Diversity?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, first, Chris, let's start with understanding all of many reasons why kids, so many kids, do not return to school. What are those reasons? And I'm sure there's a list.
Right. Sure. And it's a long list.
Yeah.
And some of those reasons are academic, and certainly a lot are non-academic as well. So
some of them are financial. I mean, that makes sense that you get to college. One of the things that interested me, though, was that some people say that schools will entice a student by offering a financial aid package that then is not later available when they get to their sophomore year. Does that happen?
Potentially it can. You know, financial aid is a very complex and very nuanced thing, and that's kind of on the other side of campus. I jokingly tell students, I don't deal with anything having to do with money, so I'll defer to the experts on those things. But I do know that there are, you know, circumstances where students come in thinking that their aid package is going to cover a certain amount, and the reality is it's only tuition and fees. They don't think about some of the living expenses, things like that. Or it's just more expensive than families anticipate. And so they run out of money.
So let's go through some of the other reasons. And in this, we can bring Julie into it. Because one of the things which interested me was the difference between expectation and reality. And this is pointed to by a lot of students as to why they left. And those expectations can be anything, the difficulty of the classes, how the college will be. But how does the expectation of the students impact whether they return?
Well, I think that there are students who come in certainly with a set of expectations, and when they are met with adversity, whether that first exam was kind of a kick in the mouth and they really struggled academically, or they're not used to living away from home.
They're lonely.
They're homesick, they're confused, they're experiencing new ideas and thoughts that maybe they weren't exposed to coming out of high school. So what resilience do they have? What resources do they have? What are they aware that's available? And do they seek those resources out? Are they talking to advisors? Are they talking to counselors? Are they talking to their professors? Do they feel like those campus resources are not just available, but welcoming?
Yeah, I mean, you can have all the resources in the world if the students don't know about
them. If they're not being utilized, it doesn't matter, right?
So, Julie, this kind of brings us to you because students of color and first-generation students, those who are the first in their family to go to college, are much more likely to drop out. Do we know why?
I think it's important to look at both the psychological variables. That's my background is psychology, as well as environmental and contextual variables. So students of color struggle with the same issues that Chris mentioned as majority students do. But then they have some unique challenges. One of those challenges relates to being numerically underrepresented, and that very much relates to feeling a sometimes lowered sense of belonging or connectedness. So at Tech, we're very much aware of that, and there are programs in place to increase connectedness among students of color. Students of color nationwide talk about more limited role models, especially role models who look like them. That's a particular issue in STEM schools and STEM universities. And I think they're also often struggling with some myths related to their abilities or their potential. And that goes to the point of implicit stereotypes that others may hold about them.
Help me understand what you're saying. The myths about their abilities, meaning people expect more of them or less of them?
Sometimes students of color talk about experiences where faculty or others expect less of them. And I think that has a strong impact oftentimes on their own self-efficacy and their own self-estimates about their abilities to succeed.
So there an interesting comment from Dr. Bruce Niemeyer of Global College Search, and I'll put this to you, Chris. He says, quote, "A number of schools might have a more lenient admissions policy, but therefore end up admitted students that it does not have the appropriate resources to assist in making it academically." To what extent does admissions policies impact success? In other words, choosing the exact class of freshmen that are right for that university?
Yeah, so I think that there is sometimes a tension between admission standards and what that entering class looks like and what the resources are. We have a real disconnect sometimes between higher ed and K-12. You know, I jokingly say it at freshman orientation, we're treating you like adults here. But 6 weeks ago, you had to raise your hand and ask permission to go to the restroom. So, you know, what happens in that period where you develop all of these life skills where you can advocate for yourselves? So one of the things that Kennesaw State is looking at is changing how we reach out to students who have either been identified as being at risk by their faculty or who we just know might need a little bit more support.
You mean they fit statistically into a student that is more likely to drop out?
Right, or a professor says, hey, I don't have an attendance policy, but this student isn't coming to class, I'm concerned. How are we reaching out to that student? What are we doing to make sure that they're not only taking advantage of whatever resources are available, but that they're dealing with some of those non-academic issues, that it's a good fit, that they're in the right place, that they're feeling confident, empowered to do well.
So this is a place for all of you listening to give us a report on your first year of college. How was it? What was the most difficult part of your first year? You can tweet us at Westy Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guests are Chris Hutt, the Vice President of Academic Advising at Kennesaw State University, and Julie Onsis, what was the title again?
Associate Vice President.
Associate Vice President.
Institute
for Diversity at Georgia Tech. I want to make sure I got it right this time.
Yeah.
So, Julie, what are the resources? And Georgia Tech is not part of this national initiative that Kennesaw State has joined. But what kind of resources does Georgia Tech have to reach out to this kind of students that Chris was just describing?
So there are a variety of resources at TEC, and I think that's a major reason, or one of the major reasons, why we have a very high retention rate and have had very high retention rates for the past 15 to 20 years.
What is Georgia Tech's retention rate?
So current retention rate is 97% from first year to second year. Those are the latest statistics. So that's extremely high.
It is.
And it's pretty discrepant from the national average.
For context, the two of the lowest in Georgia, Clark Atlanta has only 63% retention. South University in Savannah has only 45% retention, which means less than half of freshmen return for their sophomore year. Okay, so what are these resources you put into play?
So, and I want to pick up a point that you were just speaking about with Chris. I think that the continued competitiveness in admissions at Tech definitely leads to or impacts the high retention rates. But Tech has a variety of programs related to, again, psychological, individual sorts of challenges that students face academically and socially, and also sort of contextual. So one program that's comes out of the Office of Institute Diversity is known as the Challenge Program. And that's a five-week intensive summer program for incoming freshmen. And it's a program that consists of core courses at Tech. So students come for the summer for 5 weeks. And it simulates a typical freshman year. So students become familiar with the Tech campus, with academic challenges they may face. It's also an opportunity for them to connect with other students.
Maybe make some friends.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Chris, now that you're part of this national initiative, what kind of things can Kennesaw State, because the elite institutions don't seem to have too many problems with retention. They're all up in the 90s. Harvard, Yale, not having trouble. But what about Kennesaw that has a more mixed bag of incoming freshmen?
Exactly. It's a different student population. The resources are obviously very different, and so too are the needs. So as part of this Ask You initiative, Kennesaw State is looking at four distinct buckets or areas where we feel we might be able to make a difference. First is changing the mindset of academic advising to a more proactive model where we are reaching out to students before they maybe feel like they need to see us. So in the past, advisors, whether it's faculty, staff, professional, would wait for the student to come to us. Which means there's a crisis. And often they don't realize that there's a crisis until it's too late. So we're piloting a new model this fall where we are going to be reaching out to students early and often in the hope that we can catch them before they're too far gone, so that they can still make some course corrections, some adjustments in the semester before it's too late.
Right.
We're also piloting a course redesign and some of our very high enrollment, high DFW rate courses, DFW meaning courses that students more often get a DF or a W, trying to front load some of the assignments so faculty and students get an earlier read on how students doing in the class.
That is Chris Hutt. He is with Kennesaw State University. He is Vice President of Academic Advising there, and Julie Ansis is Associate Vice President for Institute Diversity at Georgia Tech. Got to get that title correct. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you very much. It was
Thank
a pleasure
you very much.
To be here.
This is On Second Thought. The DeKalb County Police Department has purchased 600 body cameras for each of its patrol officers. The police say it's an effort to, quote, enhance transparency, accountability, and officer safety, end quote. As in other cities, though, there are some worries about whether and when footage from body cameras will be released to the public after incidents, especially deadly encounters between public and police. Joining us this morning, Cedric Alexander. He's the DeKalb County Public Safety Director. It's good to speak with you again, Cedric.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Also with me is Robert McKeeman. He is the CEO of Utility Inc. That's the Atlanta-based company that produces body cameras for the DeKalb County PD. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
And also on Skype is Chad Marlowe. He's the Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. It's good to have you as well, Chad.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
So, Cedric, let's start with you and the decision to purchase body cameras, which is quite an expensive investment. Why was it important for DeKalb?
Well, I think if you go back and look historically over time, the relationship in police and community across this country have always been somewhat challenging, particularly in certain communities, and more specifically, communities of color, of those that were less disadvantaged. So on the onset over the last couple of years of what we've all seen a lot of in terms of incidents that have occurred that has raised a great deal of concern and pause and anger among American citizens and all American citizens, a great number of American citizens across this country. It is an opportunity with the onset of iPhones and poll cameras and the technology that is out there available to us to have this type of technology available where officers themselves now become equipped with cameras, because what all the research has indicated to us is that over 80% of the interactions between police officers and community are improved as a result of body cameras.
So,
and go ahead.
I was just going to say, let me play this comment from Seattle Police Chief Operating Officer Mike Wagers. He was speaking with All Things Considered last year about what body cameras can and cannot solve.
The cameras are not a panacea, right? So if you already have a huge gap, a chasm between citizens and police, if you have a deficit already, then you have a lot of other things that you need to do along with implementing cameras.
So let me bring you then in, Chad, to respond to that particular thing about the attempt to for body cameras and whether they can cover a gap of trust.
Well, I think that answer was absolutely spot on. You know, anyone who thinks that the challenges that face, you know, police and community relations, you know, racial justice issues, criminal justice issues in this country are going to be resolved by pinning a camera to the lapel of a police officer is being, at a minimum, overly optimistic. And so I think it's actually great that is the perspective of the police department in DeKalb County, because I think that that police body cameras are a piece, but a small piece of a larger puzzle, especially in more challenging jurisdictions.
Now, Bob, your cameras are different than many of the cameras that have been purchased by other police departments. In what way?
Well, in a couple of ways. First of all, most of the cameras that are in the marketplace today are basically clip-on, manually operated GoPro clone cameras.
Manual operated, I have to turn them on and off.
Yes, the officer has to remember to manually turn it on and off. And that's a big distinguishing factor of our body cameras, is that we have the ability to do what we call policy-based recording, where the police department, Mr. Alexander and his compatriots, decide what the policies are and then have the body camera automatically start recording when the policy dictates, so that the officer doesn't have to be burdened and distracted with remembering to, did I push the start button on my body-worn camera?
Do they come off? Because we've had other incidents in which a police officer said, I didn't get the video because my camera fell off.
They don't fall off because we're pretty unique, and actually very unique, and we embed the body-worn camera inside the officer's uniform.
So, Cedric, that brings me back to you. What is the policy on when a camera is turned off in DeKalb and when it's turned on?
Well, for us, it's going to be any time that we interact with the public. And as well, we're going to make it known to the public that we are recording, whether we're outside or inside a residence. Because, as you know, from state to state, jurisdiction to jurisdiction, you may have a variety of different laws. But I think the key here is the most important thing is that
Cedric, you're moving around a bunch. It's hard to hear you for all the background noise.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that our policy is going to require that you, anytime that you interact with the public, you have to have the camera on. And we're going to inform the public, whether we're inside a resident or outside a residence, that they're being recorded.
So a traffic stop, the camera will go on.
Absolutely. On traffic stops, any engagement, we have a call for service, traffic stop. But look, here's the thing. Body cameras certainly are not a panacea, but what they do give us is an opportunity to acquire as much information as we can around an incident that occurs. So however it's being reported as a complaint, or if there's some conflicting testimony between that of the officer or the citizen, the body camera helps us work through that. Now, depending on angle, depending on what may be going on, it could be a scuffle involved, it could be a variety of things. Sometimes your footage is going to be very clear, and at times it may be a little bit more tough to go through. But I think the important piece is here is that for the public, it creates a situation where there's greater, more accountability on the public's part and on the police department part as well. So it's good technology, and we cannot move forward, I don't think, in the 21st century without having this technology, and not just for checks and balances of police, but I think just overall that is the technology of the future, and we want to make sure that we are at the forefront of it in advancing policing in this county and across this country.
So, Chad, let me play you this comment from Katie Townsend. She's litigation director at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Now, she's speaking with CNN here, and granted, she's talking about a North Carolina law, but this law restricts the release of footage from these particular cameras, and she sees that as a serious problem.
It imposes hurdles on actually obtaining access to the video, so it requires them to obtain a court order, which makes it extremely difficult for individuals to obtain body cam footage.
Chad, how concerned are you? How important is it that once this footage is taken, that the public has access to it, that it becomes part of the public record?
Well, it is important at times. Body cameras are unto themselves neither good nor bad. It all depends on the policies governing them. What we've already heard, in this interview from DeKalb County, we've heard two really good points. We've heard them take a position about the body cameras being on in all law enforcement type encounters. That's a great decision. We've also talked about, they've also expressed that it is their policy to have their officers inform the public that they're being recorded. That's a great decision. The reason that's a great decision is evidence has shown that when the police and the public know they're being recorded, they tend to act better, and that increases the safety of everyone involved. But another important policy for body cameras is who gets to see the footage. And the challenge there is balancing the need to promote police transparency and accountability on the one hand and to protect privacy on the other. And so therefore, when it comes to releasing body camera footages, for certain critical incidents of importance to the public, like when there's been a police use of force, if there is a felony arrest, or if there's a police complaint with respect to what is seen on the video, those videos should be made available to the public automatically and immediately. All the other videos, someone asking where the closest gas station is, or someone, making an embarrassing fool of themselves because they drunk too much in public, those are not of value, and those should be automatically kept from the public. So really, although I agree with the statement that, the North Carolina law goes way too far to the extreme of saying that the police get to decide what is released and what is not released, and if you don't like it, you can go through a lengthy court process that is really set up not to let the public see the videos. It's a huge mountain, a hurdle that they have to overcome to get the court to order them released. That's not a well-balanced policy. And so it's incumbent upon states and local departments who are adopting policies to try to strike the right balance between promoting transparency and protecting privacy.
And that could be a work in progress. Well, we would love to hear from our listeners whether or not you think body cameras have the potential to really change relationships between the public and police. What do you think about body cameras? Tweet us at OST Talk or join us on Facebook. My guests are, you just heard, ACLU Advocacy and Policy Counsel Chad Marlowe, also DeKalb County Police Department Deputy Chief Operating Officer Cedric Alexander, and Bob McKeeman is CEO of body camera manufacturer Utility Inc., which is supplying the cameras for DeKalb. So, Bob, what about the quality of the picture? Because oftentimes we get this footage from body cameras and it is difficult to make out what's actually happening. They're not taking essentially good pictures. Why is it so difficult to get good quality?
Well, it depends on the body camera. Our body cameras record in 720p high definition, so we're providing very high quality video. It really has to do with generations of technology. A lot of the cameras in the marketplace are older VGA level quality technology. It doesn't have to be low quality, though. What DeKalb County is buying is recording in HD. Actually, our body cameras could record up to 4K video.
So, and where does the video go? Where is it stored?
The video goes straight to Amazon.com. That's a cloud-based repository. We have a very strong partnership with Amazon. And there it's safe, it's secure, and it's available to DeKalb County to view at any time.
How long, Cedric, will you be saving that footage?
We will have the footage. I can't remember specifically. I certainly can get that information back to you because I don't want to make a false statement.
Yeah.
But we will be able to have access for that, to that footage for some significant period of time. But the exact period of time, I certainly can get back to you and your listeners.
Sure. Well, let me play one more comment from Seattle Police Chief Operating Officer Mike Wagers. He's talking about laying down ground rules. And again, something that keeps coming up, how you communicate those to the public.
What is the purpose of the cameras? Is it to get at the truth of that interaction between a police officer and a citizen? Is it also to change that encounter between that police officer and the citizen to produce some benefits such as reducing use of force or incidents or citizen complaints, and then making it clear what you're not going to use the cameras for. You're not going to use the cameras for live streaming video back to headquarters. You're not going to use the cameras to attach it in real time to facial recognition technology. Those are things that you need to tackle now with your community to make sure everyone understands what the cameras are going to be used for, but also understand what they should not be used for.
So, Cedric, what kind of decisions has your department made on that particular issue, what they're used for, what they're not?
Well, here again, we're going to be very diligent, and we're going to work very closely with our legal department. And how we use this footage is going to be at the best interest of the parties that are involved. I think it's one thing that we also have to consider here. With the onset of this new technology, there are going to be questions that are going to come up that are yet to be answered. And yeah, some of these are probably going to be in the legal domain that are going to see themselves in a court of law and through appeals and right up to the Supreme Court. But we will only determine that over time. But here's what we know at this very moment, is that all the research indicates to us that this type of technology benefits both the community and the police. If nothing else, it helps build transparency. It helps build relationships. It keeps us from this place as if we're attempting to hide anything. Now, there are going to be points and incidents that will occur that video very well may not be released immediately, merely because the investigation in of itself could be jeopardized. But that's going to vary from case to case to case. But it becomes very important that when you're able to release that information to the public, you do it in a timely manner, you do it in a responsible manner, and you're doing it in a legal manner. And that is what's critically important here, is that we follow some ethical guidelines that are going to be crucial as we move forward with this technology, because it's still a lot yet to be learned and determined.
Yeah,
can I speak to that point?
Yes, go ahead.
Two things on that. First of all, the ACLU has spent literally thousands of hours talking with people all over the country, including many, many police forces, in developing guidelines for what is a good body camera policy. And we have states and police departments all over the country who've worked hand in hand with us in developing the right types of policies. And so that's certainly something that we can help any department throughout the country in terms of doing. But I do want to touch upon this issue, which is one that comes up a lot, about not releasing body camera footage because of an ongoing investigation. Now, there is a fairly well understood rule that when police departments are doing investigations, that they don't release certain information. And it's called an investigatory privilege. It's a privilege from Freedom of Information Acts and other sort of public release rules. And the reason for that rule is that when the police are doing an investigation, they do not want a suspect out there to know that they are onto that suspect or not onto that suspect and what they have learned about the case, because that could provide an advantage to a criminal suspect. But those justifications do not apply in the case of police body cameras, because in that case, the quote-unquote suspect is going to be a police officer who already knows he or she is a suspect. In many instances, he or she will have recorded the camera footage themselves, and by virtue of the way departments work, they probably have already seen the footage. And so the basis of the traditional investigatory exception to releasing footage doesn't really apply in body cameras and is often used as an excuse not to give it to the public as opposed to give it to a suspect. And so when we talk about, you know, body cameras are helpful in terms of promoting transparency, that's not really true. They are helpful sometimes. They are helpful in New Hampshire, where they have a great state law. They're helpful in Parker, Colorado, where they're very, where their police department is very transparent. But they're not helpful in North Carolina, and they're not helpful in Los Angeles, where the police departments withhold video any chance they get. So really, it all goes back again to the policies, including the policies of using investigatory privileges, in are we going to keep the most critical footage away from the public? And that's an, you know, an individual, departmental, and state choice, and they have to make the right choice.
Right. That's Chad Marlowe, Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. We also spoke with Robert McKeeman, CEO of Utility Inc., supplying the body cameras for DeKalb, and Cedric Alexander is the DeKalb County Public Safety Director. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Two years ago, Georgia Tech became the first university in the country to accept Bitcoin. But they stopped earlier this year because not enough people were using it. And if you're one of the people wondering, what the heck is Bitcoin? We're here for you. A lot of people are talking about Bitcoin. Very few people really understand it. And that means it's time to break it down.
Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Bitcoin is a virtual currency. That means there is no tangible evidence of this money. There's no check, no cash card. It's just a number in an online account. Bitcoin is one example of something called cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is not controlled by any nations, like the US dollar is or the euro. And that means it's not manipulated in the way that the Chinese yen is, nor does it rely on the fortunes of banks that are either too big to fail or too small to survive.
A digital currency in which transactions can be performed without the need for a central bank. Woody,
what is a Bitcoin?
Yes.
Who invented this currency? Well, that is the 64,000 Bitcoin question. Back in 2008, a paper was published on the cryptography mailing list. It described a new digital currency, and the author was listed as Satoshi Nakamoto. Satoshi Nakamoto is not the name of a real person. And so far, the world has been unable to figure out who the author really is. If you go to Google Images and search for Satoshi Nakamoto, the picture that you see of a 64-year-old Japanese-American is not Satoshi Nakamoto. There have been any number of theories about Nakamoto's identity, and in 2015, an Australian claimed he was the inventor of Bitcoin. His claim was debunked.
I don't know how to tell you this, so I'm just going to say it. I'm the one who pretended to be him.
You wouldn't do that.
I did. I really wish I hadn't, but I did.
If you have an extra hour or two, you can entertain yourself by reading about the search for the real inventor of Bitcoin. Whoever he or she is, they're probably rich. Expert analysis shows Nakamoto probably has about $1 billion worth of Bitcoin piled up by this point. But we will leave the detective work to others and continue with our explanation of what Bitcoin is. So, just a few months after that initial paper was published, the so-called Satoshi Nakamoto released software. It was used to create a network, and the first Bitcoins were issued. That software was open source. That means anyone can look through it, and there are no secrets in the code. Bitcoin is transferred digitally. It's transferred instantly. And the transfer usually costs nothing or next to nothing. It's also kind of anonymous. That's why governments are wary of Bitcoin. Lawmakers worry terrorists can use the Bitcoin network to send untraceable amounts of money.
There's these sites where you can sell everything from fake credit cards to illegal guns and drugs, and they use Bitcoin so they can't be traced.
But Bitcoin is not really anonymous. Law enforcement can generally follow the trail of transactions back to a real person because all Bitcoin transfers are public, completely public. Any person with a computer can look at any Bitcoin transaction ever transacted. It's all recorded in a huge digital ledger called the blockchain. Now, blockchain is another term you may not recognize. The blockchain is the data structure that underlies Bitcoin, and it makes Bitcoin possible. But blockchain can be used for so much more than currency. Blockchain is an incredibly powerful technology that could radically change the way we all do business. It could change the way artists and musicians are paid. It could revolutionize the buying of homes and the execution of contracts.
Yeah, I could do that. It should take about 2 minutes. Just PayPal me some Bitcoins when you get a chance.
What?
The possibilities of blockchain are mind-boggling, but maybe we should leave that for another time. For now, let's get back to the cryptocurrency that uses blockchain called Bitcoin. Bitcoin is non-refundable. In other words, once it's been transferred, there is no way to get it back. Not if the bike you ordered never arrives, not if somebody stole your identity and took your Bitcoin. The only way to get it back is if the person who received it chooses to return it.
Yeah, I need to return this book.
I'm sorry, we can't take this book back.
Well, you just lost a lot of business.
And that brings us to the most complicated part of Bitcoin, how you get it. There are three ways to acquire Bitcoin. You can buy it. The current value of one Bitcoin is about $680. You can also take Bitcoin as payment for a service or for something that you've sold. The last way is called mining. And I don't mean going into a cave and using a pickaxe like the dwarves in Snow White. In this case, you use a computer to mine for Bitcoin on the internet. But what you're really doing is verifying transactions. Now, let me explain. Let's say I sold you my old iPhone 6 for $50 and you pay in Bitcoin. That transaction is not verified. We don't know that you have actual Bitcoin to use for payment. So the transaction is locked away inside the blockchain. Meanwhile, other people start trying to verify that transaction. That requires special software, a great connection, and patience. According to blockchain.info, it takes more than 200 billion attempts before a miner finds the correct key for verification. And as time goes on, it gets harder and harder to find them. That's because only 21 million Bitcoins will ever exist. Remember our elusive friend Satoshi Nakamoto? He or she set a limit on the number of Bitcoins that can be circulated. There are currently nearly 16 million out there, so there are only 5 million left to find. And a new one is found about every 9.5 minutes. So if you want to get into the Bitcoin mining game, you're a little late. But you're not too late to use Bitcoin by buying some the traditional way, and then using it to pay for tuition, say, or whatever else your Bitcoin will buy. That's the basics of Bitcoin, but we do have an expert here to explain further. Nathaniel Popper is a Wall Street reporter for The New York Times and author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Good morning, Nathaniel.
Good morning.
Can we talk first about the future of Bitcoin? Georgia Tech stopped accepting it just because nobody wanted to use it. Does Bitcoin have a future?
Does Bitcoin have a future? That's a great question. And by the way, that was quite an explanation. One of the best I've heard in 2 or 3 minutes. I think the way that a lot of people imagined Bitcoin taking off was that people would sort of use it in the ordinary economy to pay for things online, maybe pay for tuition. The reality is that was never the best sort of use case for it. In the United States, we actually have a pretty well-functioning financial system. You know, our credit cards work pretty well. It's not hard to write a check for tuition. These things work pretty smoothly. Bitcoin, you know, if it's going to take off, it's going to have to be significantly better than the existing system. And it is significantly better than the existing system in a lot of the rest of the world. So you see people using it more for ordinary things in places like Argentina or Venezuela or even China, where perhaps the financial system isn't as well developed. Where you see it here in the United States, and this is something that a lot of Bitcoin folks don't like to talk about, is for black market purchases, and specifically for online black market purchases. You know, the first really famous use case of Bitcoin was on the Silk Road, which is this online site where you can buy heroin from somebody in Amsterdam and they'll send it to you. And, you know, you can't do that with a credit card. You can't do that with PayPal, because as soon as PayPal or the credit card finds out, they will tell the police. With Bitcoin, you can send that money. And most of the time, nobody can track you down. As you rightly mentioned, it's not totally anonymous, but it's actually pretty anonymous, and it's worked pretty well for these online drug sites. And so that kind of use of Bitcoin has continued and, if anything, increased, as has the use in sort of less developed countries.
Is that because most law enforcement agencies don't really know how to follow the trail of Bitcoin?
That's a piece of it, but the reality is, if you are careful about it, it is quite possible to send Bitcoin anonymously, or to send Bitcoin without it being easily traceable. Essentially, you know, the most basic element in Bitcoin is that you have a Bitcoin address that is 34 letters and numbers, and then you have a sort of password associated with that. And you are the only person, when you create a Bitcoin address, you're the only person who knows you created that. So as long as nobody else learns that that address is your address, nobody will be able to trace the transaction to you. And so there are a lot of arrests in these dark online dark markets. I wouldn't suggest that people do that. It is quite vulnerable, but the amazing thing is the degree to which it has worked, and to which a kind of new drug market has popped up online, in large part thanks to Bitcoin.
My guest is Nathaniel Popper. He's a Wall Street reporter for the New York Times, author of Digital Gold. So, Nathaniel, one of the things I think that concerns a lot of people is that Bitcoin, because it's not tangible, that it can disappear, that, you know, you can have a glitch in the computer system or a glitch in the matrix, and suddenly all your whole investment goes away. What is the chances of you losing Bitcoin accidentally or through some mistake?
Well, there are two layers to this. The most obvious layer, and I think the thing people hear most about, is that essentially somebody can get the password to your address, and they can spend your bitcoins, or they can move their bitcoins to their account. Actually, very recently, we had a situation like this. One of the biggest Bitcoin exchanges in the world out of Hong Kong got hacked, and people's passwords were compromised, and their bitcoins were transferred, and something like $60 to $70 million worth of Bitcoin were transferred out. And
you can't get it back.
And right, as you noted, Bitcoin transactions are irreversible. So there's no central authority to say, oh, that person shouldn't have those, let's give them back to you. That doesn't exist in Bitcoin. Once they are moved to that address, that person has control of them. And there's nothing anybody else can really do about it unless you track that person down. But there's another layer to it. So that is actually sort of like if somebody got the password to your bank account, they could move the funds out. As you know, if it was a bank, the bank could transfer the money back to you if it was stolen. But you know, that is in some ways. With Bitcoin, people actually like that quality, like the fact that once you transfer it, it's done. You can't take it back. But there's just in terms of sort of the Bitcoins disappearing, Bitcoins never really disappear. They are in the system, and as long as you have your password and it isn't compromised, there hasn't really been a case of Bitcoins disappearing from your account, without somebody else getting access to it. And that is because of all this complicated cryptography that underlies Bitcoin, and because this network is this, you know, global thing that's backed by thousands of computers around the world. It in some ways, it has more security than the existing financial system. In some ways, as we've talked about, it has much less security than the existing financial system. And so what people are obviously trying to do now is figure out the ways to take advantage of the ways in which it has more security and try to do away with the areas where it has less security. And it's a real balancing act. And in the meantime, people have lost a lot of money.
What are the ways in which it's more secure? This network that you talked about, from what I understand, a Bitcoin transaction, you can't, the reason you can't ever get rid of it is because it's replicated. The Bitcoin in that blockchain is replicated in every computer that's connected to it all over the world. It would be almost impossible to disappear it.
Right. I mean, you know, I guess one useful way to think about it is, you know, the security of a file that is on your computer, on your desktop, versus one that's in the cloud. You know, if you save it on Dropbox or Google Docs, if somebody that file that's just on your desktop, on your computer, if your computer gets corrupted, if you accidentally delete the file, if you drop it in the toilet, that file is gone. If it's in the cloud, it's replicated, and you're going to have access to it even if your computer goes down. That's a little bit like Bitcoin. It's like a financial system in which the record is kept on the cloud by lots of people around the world. And so even if one person on that network goes down, everybody else still has the records. And you know, that gets to this idea of the blockchain, which you hinted at. But, you know, really, at the end of the day, what Bitcoin is, it's a new way to store and move data, digital data. And it can sound a little wonky and boring, but it turns out that storing and moving data around is sort of at the core of the digital economy. You know, it's at the core of everything we, all of the sort of financial systems and information systems in the world. And that's why people are so excited about this technology, because it seems to represent a new, more secure way to store and move technology. But there are a lot of problems to overcome in the meantime.
So we have about 30 seconds left here, Nathaniel. What are the chances that in a couple years I'll be paying for my Amazon.com purchase with Bitcoin?
Well, I think probably you won't be paying online bills in Bitcoin. What's interesting is that central banks are playing with this technology to move their currencies onto something like the Bitcoin blockchain. So the pound sterling, they're playing with this at the Bank of England. The Fed is having conferences where they're talking about this. So you may pay for your bills on Amazon with a dollar that is on a blockchain, much less likely that you'll pay with Bitcoin itself, I think.
That's Nathaniel Popper, Wall Street reporter for The New York Times, author of Digital Gold, Bitcoin, and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. Nathaniel, thank you so much. Very enlightening.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today, but give me your thoughts. Would you invest in Bitcoin? Would you let someone pay you in Bitcoin? Do you trust a digital currency? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Or you can post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.